Before us today, House Bill 269. We're going to have a relatively short meeting today because a lot of us are sick and are members of other committees, which meet at other times. So we want to keep attendance up. We're going to have first Representative Boyers, then we're going to have testimony from the supporters of legislation and testimonies of opponents, and then any questions from committee members. I think we're going to hold questions except for Representative Boyer until after the all the presentations are made, except for quick clarification of what's been stated. Representative Boyer.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, for hearing House Bill 269 today. I don't want to take any more time other than to thank you for having a special meeting for this. As you both know, a number of us serve on the Health Resources and Access Task Force. One of the issues we've been looking at in that context is utilization review standards, and we're meeting again this weekend to try to come together with a package of proposals to bring to the legislature with the support of the various interests involved in that whole set of issues, which have to do not only with providing broader access to health care, but also containing some of the cost of care. And this bill before you is a piece of that approach. It's an imperfect vehicle right now. There's a very fine line to walk between trying to increasingly manage care in a way that you don't diminish the access to care by the truly needy, and yet at the same time provide for a gatekeeping mechanism that assists you in keeping health care costs down. Utilization review is a kind of management tool for narrowing the gate and keeping the cost of care in a manageable level. Unfortunately, the way that, because it's kind of a mushroom so quickly here, the whole issue of managed care and utilization review, it's a system that is not universally applied. There aren't professionals universally versed and well versed in all of the issues that relate to healthcare and the delivery of healthcare. And so the issue that we're trying to address here is just to provide some standards for that utilization review as it occurs. And again, there's nothing perfect under the sun. There's nothing perfect represented in this bill, but the bill does, I think, represent some problem areas in the current area of utilization review. And I thought it was real appropriate that this committee have before it some people who have to deal from a provider perspective with utilization review firms, and also have represented the interests of people who use or utilize utilization review firms for all of the benefits that are there with utilizing them, and have the discussion back and forth between those interests rather than take testimony essentially from lobbying interests on both sides of things. So I'll answer questions, but I think the real information that is available to the committee is here with the group of people that are going to be before you.
Thank you, Representative Boyer. I'll be really interested to see what your task force comes up with too on this subject as well as other subjects. So anything that regards this matter, if you could forward it to us, that would be a big help.
Just on that, for timing purposes, we have one work session this weekend, all weekend, and they've been fairly intensive. And then we have an additional work session in the middle of the month, I think the 14th and 15th of March, rather. And that's our last set of work meetings, and out of that should come a whole host of recommendations. And so we will be presenting them generally in a very broad-based way to the various standing committees that have bills before them, and making recommendations for committee substitutes and that type of thing where appropriate. So that should occur around the middle of the month.
Thank you. Should note for the record, too, we have Representative Ruckus, Representative Parnell, and myself. In attendance, I announced previously we're going to try to keep questions as few as possible because we only have limited time for testimony today, but we'll have opportunity for questions at the end.
Thank you.
If you could introduce maybe the point I was going to be next testifier. Oh, I think it's going to be Harlan Horn, which you don't think.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, I'm Harlan Nutz, and I'm the president of the Alaska State Hospital and Nursing Home Association. I have a very brief role with you today, but I think a very important one, and that is that we want to call to your attention today the need for House Bill 269. I'm here to speak in support of House Bill 269, and there's a couple of points that I want to make. First of all, in your packet, you'll see a sheet, and it'll show you that legislatures across the state, across the country, are addressing the issue of utilization review. And that attached to that is a list of the criteria. What are doctors, what are nurses, what are hospitals asking for in a responsible utilization review program? And that's what this hearing's all about. That's what House Bill 269 is all about. And I want to place emphasis with you that what we're talking about is access to care. We're talking about how we get Alaskans into our healthcare system. The last point that I want to make with you is that we're going to do healthcare reform. And ideally, when we present healthcare reform to this legislature, you're going to see the healthcare providers, you're going to see doctors and hospitals, you're going to see the insurance industry working together to present to you a comprehensive healthcare reform that's going to guarantee access. We need your help. We are not working with the insurance industry like we should. We are hopeful that the insurance industry today will help, as you listen to the doctors and the nurses talk about this, that the insurance industry will come up with some ideas on how do we solve this problem? How do we assure that this patient does get access to needed medical care without unwarranted delay? We're not getting that back from our friends in the insurance industry, and we need their help. We need your help. Our prepaid insurance program has got some roadblocks in it now. I don't have to remind you that we've got 60,000 or 90,000 people in this state without insurance. Our insurance industry has tended to move away from the people that are uninsurable. We now have a cost review system that's got criteria that they don't even talk about, that they won't share with the doctor on how do you judge. Does this patient get care or does this patient not get care? They don't even want to talk about it. We think it needs to be talked about. We think there needs to be an appeals process. We think that this is a reasonable approach to assuring that people get needed care. And I think that I just thank you all for being here, and I thank you for the chance to testify. But this is an important bill, and it will be part of health care reform. Thanks.
Thank you. Next, we've got Dr. Brady.
Hi, everyone.
Good morning.
Good morning. Thank you. Let me pass some of this information out, which discusses. My name is Patrick Brady. I'm an internist in private practice. I'm currently the president of the Anchorage Medical Society, and I'm a counselor on the Alaska State Medical Association. I've also, in the past 3 years, been the president of the Quality Assurance and Utilization Review Committee at the Providence Hospital in Anchorage. And I'm testifying in support of this legislation. Over the past 5 years, there's been a tremendous increase in the amount of utilization review activity. And I need to make the point that I support this utilization review activity. I think it's very important, and it's a very important aspect of helping to control costs in medicine. But I also want to state that it's important that we take a look at how this these claims are being denied and how this is impacting medical decision-making. And I also need to make the point to you that this has a tremendous influence on the practice of medicine and on decision-making that physicians make. And this legislation provides for assuring that the people making these decisions that are contracting with insurance companies and employer groups or employers are qualified to make these decisions. There's no assurance currently that these decisions aren't being made by people in accounting or actuarial analysts or other people in the insurance industry. And I have several examples from my experience as a committee member in our utilization review committee in Providence of flagrant abuses by utilization review firms. And I'd like to briefly just discuss some of these cases because I think this illustrates the rationale and the need for this legislation. Recently, we had an elderly woman with Alzheimer's disease admitted to a hospital with recurrent right side of pneumonia. She was in the hospital for 7 days, received 7 days of IV antibiotics, and was discharged. Approximately 3 weeks after her discharge, we received notice that the insurance company was denying the last 4 days of her, 3 days of her hospitalization. And we appealed, and this is what my committee does. We sit, we look at the case, we review it, we make our determination of whether the hospitalization was medically necessary. And we write a letter to the review agency or the insurance company, explaining our rationale for supporting the need for hospitalization. In this case, we received a form letter back stating that Again, very similar to the first letter, we appreciate your appeal, but this is denied based on medical necessity, and period, and that's it. And that was our only recourse. The second case, 79-year-old man admitted to the hospital with colon cancer. This was resected by a surgeon. He was in the hospital for a total of 7 days. On the day of discharge, he had his surgical drain removed. The reviewers, again, reviewed the case and denied the last day of his hospitalization, denied payment for the last day. The rationale, I could have been discharged early. They seem to suggest that we discharge this man with the drain in place. But again, they offer no rationale, and nor are they obligated to offer us any rationale for their explanations, nor do they share their criteria for making these decisions. This activity also occurs and is increasing in the outpatient arena. We do a lot more hospital or medical care in an outpatient setting now. I recently had a 40-year-old man come to me complaining of headaches. His headaches were progressively worse over a 3 or 4 week period of time, and I was concerned that he might have a tumor. I think statistically it's unlikely, but I was concerned about this, and I explained my concern to him and suggested that we get an imaging study of his brain. And I talked to him about the various types of imaging studies, and the data suggested that MRI scans are the best technology available for detecting this type of problem. And we ordered the MRI scan. He reported to his insurance company, as he's required to do, and I got a call from a physician in Michigan the next day telling me that, asking me about the case. And I explained the case, and I explained my rationale for ordering the test. And he said, well, that's fine. We're not going to pay for it. And I said, well, this is my rationale for ordering the test. Why aren't you going to pay for it? And he says, I can't tell you that. That's proprietary information. And that's the end of my, that's the end of the story. So this type of problem is pervasive throughout medicine. There are numerous examples. I have numerous colleagues who would be happy to share their experiences with you. But I think the point of this legislation is really to regulate this industry, to protect the consumers who have agreements with their insurance companies for healthcare coverage. And that's really all I think I have to say. I want to keep it short.
Representative Becker, we're trying not to ask questions. Unless you have something really good, because we'll get there and lose time and your ability to ask next. And you'll have a chance once it's all complete to ask questions. Some members might have to leave before. We'll go next to Geneva Craig in Anchorage. Geneva, are you there?
Yes, can you hear me?
Loud and clear, go ahead.
My name is Geneva Craig, and I'm the Director of Population Management. And this first planet at Providence. Thank you for this opportunity.
Janine, this is David Finkelstein here. Could you get closer to the mic, please? We have a tough time hearing you.
Okay.
Is
that better?
She's a nurse.
Is that better?
That is better.
Thank you. I will address some of my concerns about the increased workload, about cost. And I have a case example. I have a couple, but I won't waste time by taking several.
Janine, I should note, too, you're only going to have about 3 minutes because you're trying to complete all the testimony in half an hour before we lose all the committee members. So go ahead.
We'll get started. One of the things that has occurred as a result of the review session, the increase in the amount of workload for the utilization review department out in the hospital, the number of calls in our department has more than doubled in the past 2.5 years. We are now calling review company, outside review company, on an average of about 1,200 calls per month from Providence alone. The review companies tend to give only a couple of days approval at a time, even though the patient's condition and the information that we give them indicates that we require at least 3 to 4 days for this patient's stay. But the thing is, they want to monitor much more closely, and so we end up doing more work. Another thing is the appeals process. Oftentimes, we have been denied patients that has been approved prior to admission into the hospital. What does this mean? It means that the patient follows the procedure of notifying their insurance company to let them know that they're going to have a surgery or they're going into the hospital for a procedure. The insurance company then say, okay, we will three paid overnights in the hospital for this procedure. The patient comes in, stays three nights, and go home. Sometime later, I will get a notice from the patient accounts department who inform me that the insurance company has denied one day. Sometimes, some cases, as much as 2 days, but no reason. We have no basis for the denial. Then that takes a lot of time, and it's costly to investigate, find out what they're reasoning for, and they tell you often, every time, you must send a medical record along with your letter. So we try to get the doctor who was on the case to write an appeal letter, or I will draft an appeal letter. We xerox the chart, the medical record, and have it sent to the insurance company. Then we wait weeks, and I have, in some cases, months, to hear from them to see whether or not the case has been approved or not. This is costly, especially when the patient knew prior to admission, the hospital knew prior to admission, and the insurance company who gave us the information that this patient's stay had been approved for that length of time. This has happened on numerous occasions. That costs money. And that costs, how do we offset costs? Well, increasing the bills for how we offset costs. I can give you a lot of examples. I won't take the time. Just remember, there are various tactics being used by outside review agencies to deny payment. We are watching those people. We are trying to catch and identify all those tactics, and we try to call them on it. This will continue, but there should not be a need for this. We should be honest and upfront with each case. Thank you.
Thank you, Janine. Appreciate your taking the time to testify today. The last person we've got is Kathy Cronin. Kathy?
Hi. Thanks for the opportunity to be here today. My name is Kathy Cronin. I'm the administrator at Charter North Hospital in Anchorage. In the interest of time, I won't tell any more horror stories. I'll just briefly summarize what I think the key points of the bill are. The first and probably one of the most important points of the bill is it creates a level playing field for medical decisions. The review criteria for which the utilization review firms use to make their medical decisions is published, and we can then understand clearly why decisions are made instead of this kind of ambiguous and gray area that seems sometimes arbitrary to us. The second highlight of the bill is it requires utilization review firms to disclose the qualifications of the people conducting the review. This is very important. We need to know that the person doing the review, reviewing and approving the procedure, is in a like discipline. For example, if an obstetrician is needing to perform a hysterectomy, we feel it's important that an obstetrician reviews that case as opposed to a family practice doctor. So it clearly articulates what the qualifications of the personnel are who are doing review. I think finally another highlight of the bill would be that it prohibits retrospective denial. And both Dr. Brady and Geneva spoke about the problems that occur when a procedure is pre-authorized, it is reviewed while the patient is in the hospital, the insurance company is concurring while the patient is there, and then 2 weeks later, 3 weeks later, the entire claim is denied. We feel that that's certainly unfair to the hospital, and it's unfair to the patient. And if they are reviewing the case truly while the person is in-house, that should be sufficient. So those would be the highlights, and I'll turn it over for any questions if you have.
Thank you, Kathy. I think what we'll do is try to go through the next two witnesses and then go back to questions.
Okay.
Dr. Winslow?
Hi, I'm going to spend...
If you could introduce yourself for the record, please.
Yes. I'm Connie Winslow, and Mr. Chairman and members of the House Legislative Commerce Committee, I'm here on behalf of Aetna Health Plans in opposition to HB 269. I'm a board-certified internist, I'm a fellow with the American College of Physicians, and I'm also a member of the clinical faculty at the University of California, San Francisco. My training was at UC San Francisco and at the University of Pennsylvania. I've been with Aetna Health Plans for 5 years. For 4 of those years, I was a director of research and program development in medical management. It's a department that's responsible for designing cost containment and quality assurance programs. Recently, I relocated to the West Coast and I'm now regional vice president for medical management. My role now is an internal advisor on medical management issues to all of the Western Region Aetna Health Plans departments. Prior to joining Aetna, I was an associate professor of medicine at UCLA and a research scientist at the RAND Corporation. My work at RAND included studies on the appropriateness of use of health services, variations in medical care practices, and an evaluation of the NIH Consensus Conference. Utilization review refers to a set of techniques used by or on behalf of purchasers of health benefits to determine medical necessity and the appropriateness of service. Its purpose is to assure the quality of care is maintained while providing the most efficient set of healthcare resources. A great majority of Americans are enrolled in privately and publicly funded health plans. Over 90% of privately insured employees are involved in a health plan that has utilization review. And of course, Medicare and Medicaid have some form of utilization review. So the majority of the people in the United States that have insurance or health benefits of some kind are subject to UR. The rationale for utilization review is threefold. In a predominantly fee-for-service system, there's considerable unnecessary and inefficient care provided to patients. Two, unnecessary care can be controlled, saving substantial monies and improving the quality of care. And three, the cost of operating utilization management systems is small compared to the savings. UR is normally conducted by nurses and physicians or other healthcare providers in specialized UR firms that either work for employers or third-party company payers like insurance companies. Right now, utilization review is one of the best means available that we have to contain costs in the United States. There is substantial unnecessary care being provided in our fee-for-service system. Studies that I was involved with at the RAND Corporation showed that between 10 and 30% of diagnostic tests, medical procedures, and hospitalizations are unnecessary. That's a very large number. Other medical services may be necessary, but they may be more appropriately offered in alternative settings. Unnecessary and inefficient care drives up the cost of care without improving patient well-being. And this is particularly important when we're looking at burgeoning healthcare budgets. This legislature, along with almost every other one in the United States, is looking at ways to manage healthcare costs without sacrificing patient care. Several studies have demonstrated a significant impact on hospital length of stay and total healthcare costs by UR. For example, in a study recently published in the New England Journal of Medicine, utilization review reduced admissions by 13%, inpatient days by 11%, and total medical expenditures by 6 to 8%. We did a study at Aetna on our Healthline program, and Healthline reduced inpatient days by 8% and total healthcare costs by 4%. There are several other studies that have looked at this, and overall in the United States there's been a dramatic reduction of community hospital bed days from 1981 to 1988, starting about the time when UR was introduced. There are a lot of concerns about the quality of care then, since we're showing dramatic reductions in hospital days. There have been several studies that have looked at the impact on quality of care of these types of programs. One was a big study, again done at RAND, on Medicare's prospective payment system. This study showed that despite the introduction of the prospective payment system by Medicare, the mortality rates at 30 days and 180 days did not change, although what they did see was a substantial improvement in the process of care by those institutions. Another study by Project Hope, this time on the impact of pre-admission review, found no evidence of harm. And another study that looked at patients whose proposed hospitalizations had failed to receive certification, looking at those patients, again, showed no evidence of harm. On the other hand, the American Hospital Association survey found that one-third of responding physicians said that they believed that their patients suffered additional injury or illness resulting from delayed authorization. However, the response rate of the survey was only 30%. And looking at the results, it seems likely that the physicians with philosophical problems with prior review were more likely to respond to the questionnaires than those without. Overall, prior review could improve the quality of care. Unnecessary care can expose patients to unnecessary and unbeneficial risks from anesthesia, blood transfusions, hospital errors, adverse drug reactions, and other hazards. Utilization review is a common and important cost containment program in the United States. House Bill 269 proposes a regulatory system that's administratively burdensome, adding unnecessary paperwork on all sides to an already complex process. In addition, the proposed program would significantly increase the cost of utilization review, would severely limit the program's effectiveness, and eliminate a popular and unobtrusive program. The program I'm talking about is referred to in Section 8.85.30B9. This restricts access to an on-site nurse. This program involves inpatient care review by a nurse that is on-site at the hospital. In our program, it's Providence. The program seems popular with physicians, hospitals, and patients, and substantially reduces the hassle factor for the providers. And yet, this section would eliminate that program. Please keep in mind that most of Aetna Health Plan's business is administrative. Most of our customers are self-insured. We provide utilization management services to our customers in order to reduce unnecessary health services. If healthcare costs continue to rise, customers will be forced to reduce benefits or to drop their healthcare benefit plans altogether. The State of Alaska policy is a good example of the benefits of a UR program to a customer. As a result of an agreement between state employees and the prior administration, UR was added to the state plan. Utilization rates for admission and bed days have declined as a result of utilization review. From 1989 to 1991, your bed days per thousand were reduced by 31%. The State of Alaska employees this population is still at the high end of utilization. If you compare our total book of business, which is across the United States, the average number of bed days is 404 compared to 625 bed days per thousand for the state. With this brief background, I will turn this over to Daryl. Is that correct? I will turn this over to Daryl. I ask you, as you listen to testimony today, to please ask yourself whether the problems raised by the medical providers will be solved by this legislation, and whether there is a simpler solution that does not require the addition of new state employees and does not unnecessarily increase the cost of providing care to the people of the state of Alaska. Thank you.
Thank you. I'll note for record, too, we've had in attendance Representative Taylor, Gruffman, Donnelly, Finkelstein, Ivan, and Parnell. Representative Donnelly has since left. Daryl Logan, are you there in Anchorage?
I am. Can you hear me?
Very well. Go ahead, please.
Okay. My name is Daryl Logan. I'm representing Human Affairs of Alaska, and we're in opposition to the bill. I've provided employee assistance services in Alaska since 77. Company Human Affairs of Alaska currently works for over 269 employers in the private and public sector. Our services in Alaska cover over 80,000 people, including over 33,000 Alaska employees. Our primary mission is to provide and manage mental health services for these employees through employee assistance and managed care programs. The managed care components include utilization and concurrent review designed to assure that covered employees and family members receive quality health care in a cost-efficient manner. Our programs have been very effective. For example, a customer we were serving since 1983 with employee assistance services became concerned about the ever-growing number of acute care psychiatric beds in Anchorage as companies increased exposure to very large claims. This customer covers about 2,500 persons with their major medical health program. We expanded the customer's EAP services to include managed care, including utilization review on January 1 of 1989. During the first year, we reduced costs from $334 per employee per year to $135 per employee per year, a gross savings of $176,000 for this employer, net savings of over $150 when you deduct our costs. We achieve these savings by providing outpatient alternatives to families and by discouraging inappropriate inpatient admission. We reduce the number of admissions by half, the average length of stay by one-third, and the inpatient days per thousand by two-thirds. None of us in Alaska predicted the proliferation and television promotion of acute care psychiatric and chemical dependency programs in the 1980s. Worse yet, we did not envision that these facilities would adopt initially treatment modalities incorporating long lengths of stay that would result in dozens of claims against employers' health insurance of over $100,000 per claim. This tremendous increase in claims has had enormous impact on the employer's cost of providing. FDA utilization review services like ours. I think if you pass this bill, you discourage the only choice the employer has to maintain a decent amount of coverage by managing through UR. Again, we strongly oppose the bill. We think the legislation would seriously undermine the last 7 years of progress made by the employers in concert with Human Affairs and other managed care companies to contain rampant inflation of mental health and chemical dependency treatment costs in Alaska. In our opinion, the cost to obtain licensing by developing the required application and paying license fees and maintain such licensing would far outstrip the current revenues we get to require the and provide the cost-effective and efficient services. Our current fees charged to companies to provide managed care services to employers with an existing EAP by assistance program is less than $2 additionally per employee per month. We estimate the cost of obtaining licensing would exceed our current annual revenue for providing these services in Alaska, with the end result of us choosing to either abandon providing such services or pass the cost of bureaucracy onto the customers through rates that would, by our initial estimates, conservatively quadruple the cost. Requirements in the bill alone requiring RNs, for example, we have a staff of 25. We have no RNs on staff. All of the people doing the EAP services and the utilization review services in our staff are either medical doctors, are one medical doctor, and the rest are master's level clinicians, professionals that have been serving in Alaska for many years. So at best, we would recommend changes to the language that would allow us to continue in business. The bill would disrupt progress we've made in fostering congenial relationships and partnerships between our firm and the professional providers of mental health services in the community. We currently have a broad range of private clinicians, physicians, and hospitals working compatibly with our clinicians in providing managed care services to the employers we serve. Since we initiated managed care, we have been able to resolve the concerns between our UR reviewers and the provider community in an amicable manner. And providers are continuing to make applications with us to become part of the network under the current reduced process every day. Some of the current providers we have been working with since the beginning is Providence Hospital, Northstar Hospital, Langdon Psychiatric Clinic. My opinion is you're attempting to fix a system that is working, that is not broken. The bill appears to imply that the utilization review is a form of medical or healthcare practice, and licensing is required to protect the public interest. We believe that this is based upon a misunderstanding of the nature of utilization review. Note that the utilization review process does not render directions to a provider to alter or refuse any course of treatment. Rather, it offers an assessment of the medical necessity of proposed care for the purpose of offering an advance indication concerning benefit. Utilization reviewers have no authority to direct the provider or the patient to do or admit anything, and the provider and patient are always the arbiters of the final treatment plan. This bill could further discourage employers that have chosen to manage mental health benefits and drive them to join with the Alaska employers that have already cut out mental health benefits for their employees. The situation would not protect patients, but leave them without benefits. Further legislation is promulgated to establish employers ensuring employees must have minimum amounts of coverage that could result in people losing all benefits, MedSurg as well as mental health. We oppose strongly the exemption of hospitals from licensing. The lower 48 states, hospitals have competed aggressively in the employee assistance marketplace. It would be grossly unfair to provide such an advantage to hospitals, and instead of it providing a level playing ground, it would certainly provide a lopsided playing ground in terms of us continuing to compete if we had to bear the expense and exposure of complying with licensing and the hospitals did not. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Darrell. I appreciate your testimony. Should note, too, for record, we've got with us today Ann Boudreau from the administration and a variety of others. We're going to go to questions now. Anyone who's testified previously, is there any questions any committee members like to ask? Representative Parnell.
Mr. Chairman, I'll need to go to Judiciary Committee to help make the quorum, but I did want to ask the previous speaker, Mr. Logan, if he could forward to you and to your staff and to those of us that are interested, suggested modification of language, which would help and still not detract you totally from the intent of the bill. And we could either have that faxed down or he could get mailed to us. Or I understand Mr. Stoops is coordinating with you too, so if you can hear you. So would you be able to ask him to?
I think so. I think he can hear you as well.
Thank you.
Sure. I think that's a great suggestion. Any other questions for any of the witnesses? Representative Brockman.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I'd like to find out what the exact cost would be. The last previous speaker indicated a tremendous cost to become licensed. What it cost his particular facility, human resources, and licensing fees.
Mr. Logan, did you hear the question?
No, she was breaking up. I didn't hear.
The question is, do you have any estimates of what it would cost you to meet the licensing requirements of this bill or for other companies?
The only experience I am aware of is in our sister company in California, Human Affairs of California, in complying with the Knox-Keene bill, which is somewhat similar. It isn't directed at just utilization review, but entire employee assistance field. It costs, my last understanding was in excess of $100,000 to do the initial paperwork. I don't know what their annual paperwork requirements are. I could check on that, but obviously, the hospitals would have a better understanding of what the cost of maintaining hospital accreditation is and that type of thing. Right now, currently, we have our professional licensure, our professional associations we keep up with, and that's pretty minimal cost.
Mr. Chairman, perhaps the speakers that are representing Charter North and Providence could answer.
Sure, maybe Dr. Brady or
this is a question that has come up before.
Can you just identify yourself for the record?
Oh, sure. Kathy Cronin, Charter North. This is a question that has come up before and is a valid question because what we don't want to do here is increase healthcare costs. We believe that the benefits of UR in decreasing costs can be maintained with our bill. And what we did is we queried the states where the bill has passed or similar legislation has passed. And each of you in your packet have a copy of bills, states which have passed bills, and the specific items that were addressed in each one of those bills. In querying these states, the cost ranged anywhere from $2,500 per year. And this is
per,
a real key.
Excuse me, per what?
For the actual applications and licensing. The confusing part for me to try and estimate what the actual operational costs would be is in many of these cases, in talking to utilization review firms, they say they're already compliant. They're complying with the things in our bill. So it doesn't seem like there would be any additional operating costs if they are already compliant. The only additional cost would be the actual fee that would be charged by the state to license. Does that answer
that
your
helps.
Question?
Thank you.
Any other questions for Andy?
Mr. Chairman, I'd like to know your intent on moving this bill along. I'd like to say that I'm totally supportive of this bill. In fact, I would find areas to strengthen it to provide more protections to the consumers and recognizing that I think there's been many problems in recent years over patient coverage being denied arbitrarily, not for medically sound reasons. And I think it would be it has to be medically justified, and the burden of proof should be on the insurance companies or the utilization review process to show that a patient isn't that a procedure isn't necessary. In other words, Mr. Chairman, I would support this bill and work to see that it passes through.
Thank you, Representative Brockman. We're going to hold another hearing and allow public testimony at that point. This is sort of a special hearing because of who we could get to town today. So.
Okay, your timeline?
No. Representative Taylor.
Well, if that's really the concern, couldn't we accomplish that through regulation within the current existing insurance laws? The complaints seem to be aimed at in the insurance industry itself, not at the providers.
Do you want to answer that, Candace? Doctor, would you like to?
Yeah.
Regarding
that, actually, Patrick Brady. Most of these companies that have proliferated in the lower 48 have are private organizations that are not insurance companies. They're organizations which contract with insurance companies to handle a segment of their business. They also contract with employers and can do a similar type of activity. So I think I'm not sure if they would if insurance regulations would cover this type of activity.
Why wouldn't
it? I think we could, thank Dr. Brady. Anne, if you could join us, you might, if you have any enlightenment to add on that question. you can identify yourself as well.
Yes. Thank you, Mr. Chairman. My name is Ann Boudron. I'm Director of Occupational Licensing. Frankly, I agree with Representative Taylor 100%, and I asked that same question last year. And all I know is that the Division of Insurance didn't really want to take on this assignment. The bill itself actually is nonspecific. It just says the Department of Commerce and Economic Development, which has both a Division of Insurance and a Division of Occupational Licensing. And so the bill itself doesn't say that it would have to be through the Division of Occupational Licensing. And while it is true that some of them are separate entities, I believe that there are some very close connections. You might want to check with the previous speaker, but I believe Mr. Logan is a subsidiary of Aetna, to the best of my knowledge. But whether they are or whether they're merely contracting with an insurance company, if the idea is to split that off, it seems to me that that's relieving the insurance company of a level of responsibility because they're acting according to their instructions. But, you know, there may be more to this than I'm understanding, but it would seem like it's if you in other businesses where you have like a real estate broker, they are responsible for their salespeople, even though each one of them is separately licensed. There has to be some overall responsibility from the place that the instructions are coming from.
Mr. Chairman, aren't we going through, or we have gone through, I guess, I sat through several hours of this now, an extensive review of insurance law in the state right now. There was a whole notebook around here for a while, and I thought we spent a considerable period of time on this very question as to what the rights and responsibilities of both the agent and the insurance carrier itself were us. In fact, extensive redefinition of agent. And that's what these people are. They are an agent working for the insurance company.
I think the I had so many hearings ago. My memory of that discussion was in the context of the obligation of the agent to inform the insured of their opportunities for discounts, that sort of thing. I'm not sure we got into this bigger area here.
Yeah, we were talking basically about selling insurance and also obligating companies to be liable for various things. Who could, in fact, obligate a company to be liable? Well, that's in fact what these people do. They're the ones who determine whether or not, when you call in as an insured, a person that's contracted with them for health insurance, you call in and you say, I want to have my Crinus Fargan and the Dugas brand both worked on tomorrow. They say, well, we can't do that because you have to have pre-authorization. You now have to clear that through, quote, mutual of we'll help you, our agent, your appendectomy.
I think your point's well taken as an argument on this bill, but I do think it's properly before us. I'm not suggesting that.
I was just thinking that before we try and do two things at once here, one thing on the insurance level, another thing on the let's go out and license these people and certify them as if they're some new group of professionals in the state. I mean, why reinvent a light bulb over here and create another burden for the Department of Occupational Licensing, when in fact the whole thing could probably be taken care of in-house through Department of Insurance anyhow?
They do, and I just would note again something I said before you came, Representative Taylor, that this is one of the issues that our Legislative Health Care Access Task Force, which Nancy Cornwell is working on, and she's here, this is one of the issues they're trying to address. We should have recommendations from them in regard to that as well.
Oh, will they be making?
They will be making recommendations on this, and their membership involves legislators, providers, consumers, etc. So, insurance agents.
Mr. Chairman, March 15th.
That's the date that they promised us. So, any other questions for Ann before we go to other questions?
I guess my only other question. We're going to wait until March 15th to hear from them?
Well, no, I've asked them to give us their recommendations as soon as they can. They may well have something from this weekend. We're not sure, but they're going to get it to us as soon as they can.
Oh, good.
And I think, Representative Taylor, you made your point, and Ann, you know, agreed that there is a thing. I want to go into other questions. So. I have a couple questions. Other questions for committee members? I did have a couple for Dr. Brady. You can join us again. I don't want to pursue this line of questioning we were just at from Representative Taylor, but you might want to at some point respond and write to the committee as well on this issue of who's properly being regulated. I think one of the most important things in this issue is establishing whether there's a problem, the degree of the problem. And so what I think it could be a big help to this committee on, and you and others in support of this legislation, is trying to develop more examples of what's gone on, you know, not without violating the confidentiality of whatever record keeper you're doing, providing records with, you know, out the names of the people or something. Certainly, a few examples don't prove a case because obviously, you know, mistakes can be made. But I think, you know, I got a lot out of the two examples you gave, and I think other examples will give us a chance to approach some of the insurance companies and try to get a response on how the system's working. Most of this is beyond the ability of most legislators to understand because we aren't seeing it occur. We aren't the ones out there making the calls, and we're strongly affected by what interaction we do have with the system, good and bad, on it. So I guess that'd be my first request. The on the issue of the disclosure, is there some level that's a middle ground? You know, I can understand the point of view that you expressed that we, you know, it isn't fair to have things turned down with no justification. On the other hand, it's easy to understand the point of view of the carriers that as soon as, and I'm not saying this is their whole argument, but this is what they've argued in the past, that as soon as they lay out a set of criteria, then the providers find some way to fit within those criteria. And I, you know, this is just a case where we all have our own examples. I had an example where a provider who was dealing with me was trying to make sure I got coverage for something and basically checked every possible box. I can't remember the exact category, but gave every possible symptom that might cover it so that it would get approved, and it did get approved. Is there some middle ground out there in this, in the level of information they provide that would not destroy their ability to protect their proprietary information?
Yeah, this is Patrick Brady. Well, with respect to the first part of your question, I'll be happy to provide you with more examples and ask some of the physicians who sat on my committee to give examples of some of their experiences. I think the problems have occurred when we have specialists such as neurologists trying to certify neurologic procedures or certain tests or necessity of hospitalization over the phone to a practitioner who has a very limited training in their specialty. And this becomes a very difficult problem. And in those instances, it would be very helpful for us to understand what the basis of their clinical decision making is, and that's really what it is. That's going on. In other words, we have a physician on the other end of the line who's making clinical judgments based on the information we're passing to them about medical necessity, yes, necessity of further testing or further hospitalization. But I will be happy to provide you with more examples. With respect to the second question, is it necessary that we have access to the criteria? Well, I served on the peer review organization of Washington, Alaska, Bond Insurance Council for a couple of years when I first came to town. And PRW is charged with monitoring both utilization and quality assurance for the Healthcare Finance Administration, basically all Medicare hospitalizations and claims. They provided us, the practitioners and the institutions, with several volumes of intensity of service and severity of illness criteria. These criteria that they use to judge the medical necessity of hospitalizations on a daily basis. And that system has worked very well because we exactly know what's expected of us. We know who meets what criteria, and our nurses, our utilization department knows exactly who's going to get denied. It doesn't even have to leave the hospital. The nurses come by and review these records, and they can say to the physician, look, this guy doesn't meet this criteria. This isn't going to pass. And something's done about it in a prospective fashion. It avoids it, and for us, it has resulted in the avoiding a tremendous amount of paperwork and letters going back and forth. And I think that I'm not certain if there's anything magical about these criteria. I really don't understand because I think I think the concerns on the health and the insurance industry's part is that by providing us with this information, we'll somehow game the system to our advantage. And again, I want to tell you myself, I support utilization review, and this bill does not eliminate utilization review. And I don't think it will impact nearly as much as they would like us, or like you to believe that it would. I think what it does is provide us with fair playing ground. And if they don't want to give us the specific information, perhaps they can just give us the data set. I mean, I have limited knowledge of the types of data that they use, but I understand that they purchased this from other vendors. If they could just tell us which set of criteria they're using, we can purchase that for ourselves and take a look at it and have some knowledge of it.
I think the question I asked was, is there a potential for a middle ground out there? Because my own experience, and I'm sure the experience of others, is that providers do try to fit into the criteria and do take steps to alter their recommendations based on what's going to be covered. And so if that's the case, let's not quibble about that, because it may or may not be the case. One person's experience doesn't prove anything. But is there a potential for some middle ground out there? I just don't understand the nature of this information. Is there something that they can provide you which won't give away the game for them?
I really don't know the answer to that question. I think the answer lies in what is and how do we define what's medically necessary. That definition, for me as a private practitioner who deals with patients on a one-to-one basis, is very different than it is for an administrator of an insurance company who deals with thousands of patients. And this is probably the root of this problem. Because in private practice, such as mine, my goal is to do the right thing and for each one of my patients. And sometimes, and I'm sure my colleagues will agree, we don't know what the right thing to do is. And I'm well aware that doing too much, that a hospital can be a dangerous place for patients. And we're all well aware of that. And I think that if there are cases where there are physicians who are committing fraud or altering records or not being truthful in their coding and their claims, and that's a whole separate issue. I don't think that issue belongs in this particular arena to me. I mean, I think that's I'd like to know what the extent of that problem is from the health insurance company's perspective. There's no question that there's a lot of needless lab work and needless work that is done. On the other hand, you have to be very cautious about how you define something as needless with medical testing, because obviously once we know the answer to the test, in retrospect we can say, gee, that shouldn't have probably been done. And I think that there's some very good data coming out, and the Institute of Medicine and other institutions, the AMA, the American College of Physicians, we're all very interested in this question. And we're developing practice parameters, and we're trying to take a hard look at the way we practice medicine. And I think that this legislation is supportive of utilization review. What it does is lay some groundwork and set some rules about how we're going to interact with this particular activity. My experience to date has been that we have no recourse when we're given denials. I had one woman 3 years ago who was denied her entire hospitalization because she failed to notify a utilization review company of her admission. She was delirious and had bacteria in her bloodstream. I had no idea who her insurance company is. I mean, I really don't. That's never an issue with my interaction with patients. Now, that doesn't happen anymore because the hospital has taken upon itself to make sure they know who's covered by who and which phone number they have to call. I have a list of 40 or 50 different numbers that we're responsible for calling on a daily basis. I mean, you know, if this were limited to one or two insurers, I think this, you know, I agree, we could take care of this through some other means, or they could voluntarily make some changes. But it's really not. We have 40 or 50 different organizations throughout the country that we have to deal with on a regular basis.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Representative Brecklin, Representative Taylor, do you have a question?
Have a chance to address this issue also.
If you could just hold on, please. Representative Taylor,
let them go ahead if they want. I'd like to hear another side of it.
Okay, go ahead, please. Is this Geneva?
This is Geneva. I'd like to get back to the provider who tries to fill in the blanks so that they can get their patient in the hospital or get certain procedure covered. Then utilization review came about, or part of the reason utilization review came about, was because there were providers who did try to fill in the blanks to get paid, or who did unnecessary tests, kept people in the hospital for a long length of time, so that they could get more money. It was because that the medical field failed to police their own. Now we've come to a similar situation when we are talking about regulating the private review company. We're not saying all private review companies are using these tactics, but there are enough of them using these tactics that we feel it warrants we develop some mechanism to regulate them, that we have a mechanism that we can fall back on to say, these people are trying these various tactics here to fill in their blocks so they can show statistically that they are saving a lot of money. And by doing that, they are depriving their clients. Their clients and the people who provide their clients the care that was medically necessary. So in essence, to your question about are there providers out there who try to fill in the blocks to get people in the door? Yes, I'm sure there are some providers out there who do that. But not all people do that. It's one of those systems where if you don't police your own group, then other people come in to police for you. And that's what's happened here with the Utilization Review Company. We now need policemen to police the police. I'm making myself clear.
Yeah, that's fine. We're here. I have a question for Dr. Winslow. Representative Taylor has a question.
Well, I just wanted to follow up on her comments and that of the doctors also. I agree with both of them. It's my sense that there have been people who have violated the system over the years, and that companies have done what they can to react. And in their reaction, I think they now have groups that are doing exactly the same sorts of injustices that are being done on the other side. If, in fact, we eliminate the company's ability to regulate those people who will receive services, don't we throw the door wide open still for those unethical doctors and proprietary hospitals who may wish to conduct additional tests, keep people in additional periods of time, etc.? I mean, where is the policeman when this one is removed?
But we're not speaking to removal.
No, okay, who regulates the docs when we put this one through?
Well, if this goes through, we still have utilization review in place. It is not an elimination of utilization review.
Any other questions? I had a question for Dr. Winslow. Well, this bill covers a number of areas, and some of them are easy to understand the objections and others. I thought maybe there are portions of this that might be more acceptable to you, and just wanted to go over those. The one provision that seems relatively minor, I wanted to see if you had any objection to, about the access to the review agents. You have to be open at least 5 days a week during normal business hours. Is that something that you object to, or is that acceptable?
What section is that? I don't have a copy of it.
It's B5 in the existing law.
Mm-hmm. All right. No, we have no problem with that.
There's also the requirement that only a physician trained in relevant specialty or subspecialty make a final determination. Now, I think, again, the message that is something you object to. And that's because of the additional cost of having those people on staff? Or is that?
We do have a large staff of all kinds of physicians. I'm a general internist, and there are all kinds of other physicians on staff. In addition, we have a large expert panel of physicians which serve as backup for our review docs if there are particular questions. So I think let me read it and then I'll see if I can just give you an exact response.
Well, I don't want to take the time to read it right now. The point I'm making is it unreasonable that the person making a determination on what's medically appropriate be in the same specialty or subspecialty, and if that isn't reasonable, and I'm not experienced enough to say what's reasonable, why isn't it reasonable?
There are a couple of different letters. Actually, a six reads, appropriately qualified review physician would be fine, wording. I think it's excessive to say that I'm not allowed to review for, as a general internist, I'm not allowed to review for a cardiology patient. Cardiologist should do that. So I mean, that seems really unreasonable to me. I think we already operate really well. The majority of the reviews are done, say, for hospital days, and it requires interpretation. You can answer if you like. It's things like how much longer should somebody be in the hospital, which really doesn't require somebody with terrific expertise, say a cardiologist, for instance, reviewing a cardiology patient, or even an obstetrical patient. I mean, if the patient's ready to go home, I can certainly evaluate that. So I think that getting involved with that level of detail, I think, is unnecessary. And I don't really think it's going to improve the quality of care at all for patients. But I think as this is worded appropriately, qualified review physician, I think that's acceptable to say it needs to be in the same specialty or subspecialty. Is administratively cumbersome. Does that mean in order to be timely, in case a cardiology call comes in, we have to have a cardiology doctor available 5 days a week during business hours to answer his pager? I mean, just the complexity is overwhelming, and it might be subject to interpretation by wherever this bill is housed. How are you going to define that? Who's going to define appropriate specialty and subspecialty? And it just seems like it goes on and on and on and on and on, where in practice a physician can review that.
And my third one I wanted to ask about that seemed less controversial is the bill prohibits retrospective denial except in exceptional cases where there's a pre-authorization made and or concurrent authorization and a denial occurs after the fact. Is that something you object to?
Yes, I object to that. There is in terms of retrospective denials, only 2% of admissions in our book of business are denied, and that includes for the state of Alaska. And we have about 40%, I think, of the insured business up here. So for 40% of the business, only 2% of admissions are denied in almost no days, because we have a nurse on staff in the hospital so that she arranges for discharge and does discharge planning and the patient gets out. So almost no days are denied here. So actually, in terms of retrospective denials for our company, they're very, very minimal. When something is denied, for instance, we had just had a case where the patient was approved for prostate surgery. On discharge, the patient had had an inguinal hernia repair. Is that what you do by opening this up? So clearly that chart's going to be reviewed. Maybe some miscommunication, it's really unclear why they, I don't know what went on there. But it is true, it will be reviewed retrospectively to try and determine what went on in that case. What you're doing by this provision is you're saying in the absence of fraud, so then we have to get into a whole big battle about, well, if that physician lied about why the patient was coming into the hospital, does that constitute fraud? And given the fact that such a small percentage of cases actually result in retrospective denial, this seems like it opens a whole can of worms for interpretation on the word fraud. So I would suggest that.
Oh, thank you, Mr. Chairman. If the speaker could refer only, to the number of patients in Alaska, I think you said you didn't know the percentage of patients that you've denied hospitalization in Alaska.
2%.
In Alaska, you said that was part of the national,
It's also
figure.
The national average, and it's also what the Institute of Medicine in their survey.
So you're saying that Aetna insurance has denied hospitalization to 2% of its insured.
2% of requests for admission are denied on average. That's our experience in Alaska. That's our experience across the country. And the Institute of Medicine did a big study on utilization review.
Okay, in those figures, are they all the same specialties, or of course are they all combined?
That 2%.
Heart patients, gynecological patients?
Mostly, I can tell you about Alaska. Mostly their admissions done on the weekend. So their admission's done on Friday. Utilization review company isn't available till Monday. So Judy, our on-site nurse up in Anchorage, doesn't see that patient until Monday morning. And that's the majority of 2%.
So on Monday morning is the point in time that the patient was denied?
That's the first time, right. Now, that does not mean that all patients admitted on a Friday. No, Dr. Brady can say he's probably admitted a lot of sick patients. He admits probably mostly emergency patients, and those get admitted, any day of the week.
After midnight.
But elective admissions on a Friday would be questioned. So of those cases that we deny for admission, the majority of them are admitted on a Friday, and then they don't come to light. Otherwise, they'd be pre-certified. If they were called during the week, we'd say, not a good enough reason, or you might be able to do that as an outpatient, or whatever it is.
Perhaps I can.
Yes.
This is Daryl Logan in Anchorage. Can I speak to the two questions regarding physician review and the retrospective review?
I'm sorry, Mr. Logan, we aren't going to be able to. We're just about out of time in the teleconference. We're trying to wrap things up. Representative Taylor had one last question.
Yeah, it just seems to me that we're leaving people like myself. I'm covered under the state program. And so I'm left in a position of having to select blindly a physician. I select that physician not knowing whether, of course, he's competent or not, or she. I just select them because I'm not feeling well. Now, I want the physician, and I have coverage, and I want the physician to treat me. The physician makes their decision that I should be admitted into the local hospital. Right? We all still playing by the same rules? Oops! I picked the wrong physician. Now, I personally have been denied my coverage, and I'm facing a hospital bill I have to pay, aren't I? Because somebody who lives in Albuquerque decided that my physician, on a telephone call, didn't have good justification for putting my little fuzzy backside into that hospital, right? I'm getting to where I like this bill a whole lot more all the time.
We as a company hold the patient harmless and will not charge and we'll go ahead and pay it as a matter of internal policy. Contractually, of course, it's not medically necessary, so we don't have to pay it. But the intent of the company is to hold patients harmless. In other types of systems, like an HMO or a PPO, the patient is always held harmless, and the responsibility is on the providers. You don't have HMOs up here, and you don't have a PPO arrangement. But those two types of managed care take the patient completely out of the loop and hold the patient harmless, both for complying with utilization review and for any costs incurred when the physician overutilizes or doesn't doesn't perform properly.
Any other questions from any committee members? I just like to repeat the request I made earlier to the advocates of the bill. Any information we could get as to examples of the kind of problems they have, this bill would, I doubt, not even be before us today except for these kind of problems, and there's very little information, especially prior to this hearing, on any examples of those kind of problems. So I think it's very important that we establish the record of the problems. My intent is to take those and submit them to the some of the insurance agents to try to get a response on how the system is working, but I think that's probably the most important step we can take at this time. Any other matter comes before the committee?
I'd just appreciate if you would follow up on that with the insurance people tonight. I'd like to see at least this bill be coordinated with the insurance litigation that the committee is currently considering, because it's such an extensive rewrite. I mean, it seems silly to pass that very large rewrite and then start, before it even gets passed, start piecemealing the rewrite. You know? So I'd really like to see the two coordinated if they can.
It's a good point. I'll try my best. I hate to say it, this bill is about five times as controversial as that whole bill, so which is about 150 pages long. Anything else come before the committee? If not, we're adjourned.